Because who you are, not just the physical dimensions of you, but the emotional ones too, change so dramatically from month to month. Edward joined the baseball team and swim team and made new friends. I reverted to my solitude. I now suppose I must have been sad about this, but curiously, I remember no feelings of sorrow, no feelings of anger. It was like the previous year had been a mistake, and I had known that things would at some point return to normal. Also, it wasn't as if there was any animosity. We had only drifted, not split. And when we saw each other across campus or in the hallways, we would both nod or wave, gestures you'd make across a wide sea, where you knew your voice couldn't carry. When we reunited more than a decade later, it felt somehow inevitable, as if we had both drifted for so long that we were bound to find each other again. There are, however, two encounters from those years apart that stood out for me. The first took place when I was around 13. I had overheard an exchange between two girls in my grade. One of the girls, it was well known, had a crush on Edward, but her friend disapproved. "You can't, Belle," she hissed. "Why not?" Belle asked. "Because," said the first girl, her voice dropping, "his mother, she's a dancer." Since he had matriculated, Edward was occasionally the subject of, not rumors, because they were all true, but stories. Eventually, we came to learn who the scholarship students were, and their parents' occupations were sometimes whispered from child to child, all mimicking the voices their own parents used to discuss the newcomers. Edward had no father, and his mother was a waitress, but he was spared from outright ridicule. He was good at sports, and moreover, he didn't seem to care what people said, which was partly what motivated the stories. I think the other students hoped that they might provoke him to react, but he never did. At least he wasn't Oriental. This was in the years of the quota, when only 10% of the school's population was Oriental, even though the territory's actual population was around 30%. Most of the Orientals who did attend arrived, in some cases, having never worn shoes, just rubber slippers. They were all on scholarships, identified by their public school teachers as promising and bright, and subjected to multiple tests before they gained admission. Their parents worked on the island's final sugarcane plantation or in the canning factories, and on weekends and in the summer, they worked there too, cutting cane, or picking pine, as they called it, in the fields, loading it onto the trucks. There was a boy, Harry, who had begun at the school in seventh grade, whose father was a night soil collector, someone who cleaned out the plantation outhouses and transferred the human feces there to where, we didn't know. It was said he smelled like shit, and although he too always sat alone at lunch, eating his rice sandwiches, I never thought of introducing myself to him. I looked down on him as well. Hearing about Mrs. Bishop made me miss her. Indeed, she was what I missed most about my friendship with Edward, the way she held me by the shoulders and then pulled me in for a hug, laughing, the way she kissed me on the forehead when I left their house for the evening, the way she told me she hoped she'd see me again soon. I had never listened to the talk about Edward, but now I did, and after a few weeks, I learned that while Mrs. Bishop was still a waitress at Mizumoto's, she was now also dancing three nights a week at a restaurant called Forsythia. This was a popular place near Mizumoto's, a hangout for union men of all ethnicities. Matthew's brother, of whom he was very proud, was a union representative for the Filipino cannery employees, and I knew he sometimes went to Forsythia, because occasionally Jane would beckon me into the kitchen after school, and with a flourish, present the restaurant's yellow bakery box, in which would sit a guava chiffon cake, its surface a glossy rose pink. "From Matthew's brother," she'd say. She was proud of him, too. and pride made her even more generous. "Have a big slice, Vika. Have more." I didn't understand why I wanted to see her so badly. But one Friday afternoon, I told Matthew and Jane I had to stay late to help paint sets for the annual school play, and then I cycled over. For Scythia, much later I would wonder who had chosen this name, as it wasn't a plant that grew in Hawaii, and no one knew what it was at the end of a row of small, mostly Japanese-owned stores of the sort that surrounded the bishop's house. And though its stucco exterior had been painted a bright yellow, it was designed to resemble a Japanese tea house, with a peaked roof and small windows cut high into the walls. In the rear of the building, though, near one of the corners, there was a long, skinny window, and it was to here that I quietly wheeled my bike. I sat down to wait. The kitchen entrance was a few feet away, but there was a dumpster, and I hid behind that. A Hawaiian music group performed here on Fridays and the weekends, playing all the big band standards, music my father had liked to listen to. Nani Waimea, Moonlight in Hawaii, I Lilue, and it was after the fourth song that I heard the guitarist announce, "And now, gentlemen, and some ladies, yeah? Please join me in welcoming the lovely Miss Victoria Namahanai Kaleleo Kalani Bishop." The crowd cheered, and I looked through the window to see Mrs. Bishop in a close-fitting yellow holoku printed with white hibiscus, a lei of orange pua keni keni around her head, her hair coiled into a bun, her lips scarlet, ascend to the small stage. She waved to the audience, which was clapping, and I watched as she danced to my yellow ginger lei and palolo. She was a beautiful dancer, and although I didn't speak more than a few words of Hawaiian, I understood the lyrics from watching her movements. It occurred to me, as I watched her, her face lit with happiness, that although I had always liked her, part of me had wanted to see her degraded in some way. Dancing, in my classmates' voices, had sounded so sordid. Something a desperate woman would have to do, and something in me had craved witnessing it. Watching her now, queenly and elegant, was both a relief and, as much as I hated to admit it, a disappointment. I realized that I resented her son after all, that I wanted him to have something to be ashamed of, and that I had wanted that something to be his mother, who had always been kind to me. Kind in a way her son could never be. She was not dancing because she had been forced to out of circumstance. She was dancing because she loved to dance. And although she dipped her head graciously at the crowd's applause, it was also clear that her joy was separate from their approval. I left before her set was over. But in bed that night, I lay awake, thinking of the night I had departed the bishop's house for the first time, and had turned back to see them in the kitchen together, laughing and talking in the house's warm yellow light. Now I revised that memory. They had put a record on the player, and Mrs. Bishop, still in her Mizumoto's uniform, was dancing, and Edward was strumming his ukulele, playing along. Outside in the tiny yard were crowded all of Edward's and my classmates, and all of the patrons from Forsythia as well. All of us watching and clapping, though mother and son never turned to acknowledge us. To them, there was only each other, and it was as if we didn't exist. That was the first incident I wanted to tell you about. The second occurred 3 years later, in 1959. It was August 21st, and the school year had just begun. I was in 10th grade, almost 16. Now that we were in high school, I saw more of Edward than I had in the previous years, when we had been assigned to single, different classrooms. Now we moved from teacher to teacher, and sometimes we were in the same class. His earlier spell of popularity, when it had been discovered he could play sports, had tempered, and now I mostly saw him around the same three or four boys As always, we nodded at each other in passing, and sometimes we even spoke a few words if we were in proximity. I think I messed up on that chem test. Oh, me too. But no one would have identified us as friends. I was in English class when the intercom crackled and the principal's voice, rapid and emotional, started speaking. President Eisenhower had signed a bill granting Hawaii statehood. We were now officially the 50th American state. Many of the students and my teacher began clapping. We were given the rest of the day off in celebration. For most of us, this was a formality, but I knew that Matthew and Jane would be excited. They had lived in the territory for 30 years. They wanted to be able to vote, which was not something I'd considered. I was walking up toward the campus's western gate when I saw Edward heading south. The first thing I noticed was how slowly he was moving. Other students were passing him by, talking about what they were going to do with their unexpected free day, but he appeared to be sleepwalking. I was nearing him when he suddenly looked up and saw me. "Hi," I said. And then, when he didn't respond, "What are you going to do with your day off?" For a moment, he didn't answer, and I thought that he perhaps hadn't heard me. But then he said, "This is horrible news." He spoke so quietly that I at first thought I'd misheard him. "Oh," I said, stupidly. But it was like I'd tried to argue with him. "It's horrible news," he repeated, tonelessly. "Horrible." And then he turned from me and kept walking. I remember thinking he looked lonely, even though I'd seen him alone many times and had never associated his aloneness with loneliness the way I did with mine. This time, though, something felt different. He looked, though I wouldn't have had the word for it then, bereft, and although I couldn't see his face, there was something about his back, the slump of his shoulders, that, had I not known better, would have made me think he had just suffered a terrible loss. I understand that that incident, knowing what you do of Edward, might not seem particularly notable, but it was uncharacteristic of the Edward I knew, admittedly not very well, back then. However, I would have known, through him or through gossip, if he had expressed any strong sentiments about Native Hawaiian rights, even given the fact that the very idea of Native Hawaiian rights had not yet been invented. Now I can hear Edward saying, "Of course it had been invented." So all right, it had not yet been named or popularized, not even on a small scale. There were a few boys in our grade who were interested in politics. One whose father was a territorial governor even got it into his head that he would one day be president of the United States. But Edward was not one of them, which made what happened later all the more surprising. I should add, though, that Edward was not the only person who was upset that day. Back home, I found my mother sitting in the sunroom, quilting. This was unusual, as she was typically with the daughters on Friday afternoons, volunteering at a food kitchen that served Hawaiian families. When I entered the room, she looked up, and we stared at each other in silence. "They let us out early," I said, "because of the announcement." She nodded. "I stayed home today," she said. "I just couldn't bear it." She looked down at her quilt. It was a breadfruit pattern, dark green on white, and then back up at me. "This doesn't change anything, you know, Kavika," she said. "Your father should still be king. And someday, you should still be king, too. Remember that." It was a strange mix of tenses, a sentence of promises and grievances, reassurances, and consolations. "All right," I said, and she nodded. "This changes nothing," she said. "This land is ours." And then she looked back at her quilting ring, my signal that I was dismissed, and I went upstairs to my room. I had no strong feelings about statehood. I thought of it as falling under the broad roof of government, and I had no interest in government. Who was in charge? Which decisions were made? None of it affected me. A signature on a piece of paper was irrelevant to the facts of my own life. Our house, the people within it, my school, these things wouldn't change. My burden was one not of citizenry, but of legacy. I was David Bingham, my father's son, and all that went with it. I suppose, looking back on it, I might even have been relieved. Now that the island's fate was settled, it would perhaps mean that I would no longer bear the responsibility and obligation of trying to correct a history I had no hopes of changing. It would be another decade, almost, before I returned to Edward's orbit. But in those years, many things happened. The first thing is that I graduated. We all did. Most of my classmates went to college on the mainland. It was what we had been groomed to do, after all. It was the entire point of the school. We were to go away and get our degrees, maybe do a bit of traveling, and then we would return after college or law school or medical school and get jobs in the most prestigious local banks and law firms and hospitals, which were owned or founded by our relatives and ancestors. Quite a few of us would go into government, leading the departments of transportation or education or agriculture. At first, I was among their number. The dean had directed me toward an obscure liberal arts school in the Hudson Valley of New York, and in September 1962, I left home. It quickly became clear that I was not meant for the college. It may have been small and expensive and unknown, but the other students, most of whom were from rich but vaguely bohemian New York City families, were somehow much more sophisticated and much better educated than I was. It wasn't that I had never traveled, but my travels had been oriented toward the East, and none of my new classmates seemed to care about the places I'd been. They'd all traveled to Europe, some of them every summer, and I was soon made aware of my own provinciality. Few of them knew that Hawaii had been a kingdom. More than one asked if I lived in a real house, by which they meant one made of stone with a shingled roof. The first time, I hadn't known how to reply. The question was so ludicrous, and stood there blinking until the other person moved away. The references they made, the books they quoted, the vacations they took, the food and wine they preferred, the people they all seemed to know, all of it whirred past me. The strange thing, though, is that I didn't resent them. I resented where I had come from. I cursed my school, where generations of Binghams had gone, for not better preparing me. What had I learned there that was useful? I had taken all the same subjects my new classmates had, but so much of my education, it seemed, had been taken up with learning Hawaiian history and bits of Hawaiian language, which I couldn't even speak. How was that knowledge meant to be useful to me, when the rest of the world simply didn't care? I didn't dare bring up who my family was. I sensed that half of them wouldn't believe me, and the other half would mock me. I knew this for certain after the variety show. Every December, the college presented a series of brief sketches by different students satirizing various professors and administrators. One of the sketches was about the school's president, who was always talking about recruiting students from new countries and unlikely places, trying to convince a Stone Age tribe boy, Prince Wooga Wooga of the Ooga Ooga was his name, to attend the school. The student playing the tribe member had darkened his skin with brown shoe polish and wore an oversized diaper. On either side of his nose was taped one half of a cardboard bone, so that it looked as if the length of it had pierced through the bridge. On his head, he wore a mop, its ropes dyed black and tied back from his face. "Hello there, young man," the student playing the president said. "You look like an intelligent young person." "Ooga booga, ooga booga. hooted the student, playing the tribesman prince, scratching beneath his arms like an ape and bouncing from foot to foot. We teach everything that a young man needs to learn in order to be considered educated, the president continued, stoically ignoring the tribesman's antics. Geometry, history, literature, Latin, and, of course, sports, lacrosse, tennis, football, badminton. And here he held out a badminton ball to the tribesman, who immediately stuffed it into his mouth. No, no, cried the president, finally flustered. This is not for eating, good man. Spit it out at once. The tribesman did, scratching and jumping, and then after a pause during which he looked at the audience, his eyes opened wide. His mouth, which had been circled with red lipstick, stretched taut. He made a lunging leap at the president, trying to take a bite out of his cheek. Help! Shouted the president. Help! The two began to run around the stage, the tribesman's teeth coming together in a sharp wooden click as he bit down on air, cackling and whooping as he chased the president into the wings. The two actors returned to the stage to loud applause. The audience had been laughing the entire time, in an exaggerated, obscene way, almost as if they'd never laughed before and were just learning how. Only two of us were silent, me and an upperclassman from Ghana, whom I didn't know. I watched him watching the stage, his face still and clenched, and realized he thought it was about him and his home, but I knew it was about me and mine. The cardboard palm trees, the ferns tied in clumsy bunches around the savage's ankles and wrists, the lei made of cut-up plastic straws and newsprint flowers. It was a cheap, coarse costume, cheaply and coarsely made, dismissive even in its ridicule. This is what they thought of me, I realized. And later, when Edward first mentioned Lipo Valnahele, it was this night that I remembered. The sensation of watching, frozen, as everything I was and everything my family was brutally dismembered, stripped naked, and pushed onto the stage to be howled at. How could I have remained there after that? I packed a bag and took a bus south to Manhattan, where I checked into the Plaza, the only hotel whose name I knew. I sent a telegram to my Uncle William, who managed my father's estate, asking him to wire me money and not tell my mother. He sent one back saying he would, but he wouldn't be able to keep this from her forever, and he hoped I was being smart. I spent the days walking. Every morning, I went to a diner near Carnegie Hall for breakfast, where I could have fried eggs and potatoes and bacon and coffee for far less than I'd have to pay at the hotel. And then I walked north or south or east or west. I had a tweed coat, expensive and handsome, but not quite warm enough. And as I walked, I breathed on my hands. And when I could bear the cold no longer, I would find a diner or coffee shop and go inside to have a hot chocolate and get warm. My identity changed with the neighborhood I found myself in. In Midtown, they thought I might be black, but in Harlem, they knew I wasn't. I was spoken to in Spanish and Portuguese and Italian and even Hindi, and when I answered, "I'm Hawaiian," I would invariably be told that they or their brother or cousin had been there after the war and asked what I was doing up here, so far from home, when I could be on the beach with a pretty little hula girl. I never had an answer to these questions, but they didn't expect one. It was all they knew to ask, but no one wanted to hear what I had to say. On my 8th day, though, Uncle William had sent me a telegram that morning, saying that my mother had been alerted by the bursar's office that I had left school, and was instructing him to send me a ticket home, which would be waiting for me that evening. I was walking back to the hotel from Washington Square Park, where I'd gone to see the Arch. It was very cold that afternoon, whipping wind, and the city seemed to mirror my mood, which was gray and bleak. I had walked north on Broadway, and as I turned east on Central Park South, I almost stumbled into a beggar. I'd seen him before. He was a squat, dark, beaten man, always on this corner, in a much too long black coat. He held before him with both hands an old-fashioned felt bowler, the kind that had been fashionable 30 years ago, and which he shook as people passed. "Spare a dime, sir," he would call. "Spare a nickel." I was passing him, about to murmur my regrets when he saw me, and as he did, he suddenly snapped, soldier-like, to his full height, before bowing at the waist. I heard him gasp. "Your Highness," he said, to the pavement. My first reaction was shame. I looked around me, but no one was staring at us. No one had seen. He gazed up at me, his eyes wet. I could see now that he was one of mine, one of us. His face was one I knew in shape and color and form, if not in its specifics. "Prince Kavika," he said, his voice slurry with emotion and alcohol. I could smell it on him. "I knew your father," he said. "I knew your father." And then he shook his hat at me. "Please, Your Highness," he said. "Please give something to one of your subjects, so far from home." There was nothing sly in his voice, only beseechment. Only later, back in my room, would I wonder why he was so far from home, how he had ended up begging on a street corner in New York, and if he had really known my father. It was possible, after all. For true royalists, which this man seemed to be, statehood was an insult, a loss of hope. "Please, Your Highness, I'm very hungry." His hat was dark, and I could see only a few coins inside, sliding around in the bowl of shiny felt. I took out my wallet and hurriedly gave him everything I had. About $40, I thought. And then I hurried on, moving away from his cries of thanks. I was Prince Wooga Wooga of the Ooga Ooga, except instead of running after someone, I was running from him, as if he would pursue me, this man who called himself my subject. He was hungry, and he would open his mouth, and when he closed his jaws, I would be within them, my head being chewed to bits, waiting for the play to be over. I went home. I enrolled in the University of Hawaii, which the graduates of my school only attended if they were poor or had poor grades. Upon graduating, I was given a job at what had been my father's company, except it wasn't actually a company, insofar as it produced nothing, sold nothing, and bought nothing. It was a collection of my family's remaining real estate holdings and investments, and aside from Uncle William, who was a lawyer, and an accountant, there was a clerk and a secretary. Initially, I showed up every day at 8, but within a few months, it became clear that my presence was superfluous. My title was estate manager, but there was nothing to manage. The trust was conservative, and a few times a year some stocks would be bought or sold and the dividends reinvested. A rabbity Chinese man was contracted to gather rents from the various residential properties, and if the renters refused to or were unable to pay, a Samoan, enormous and terrifying, was sent on a follow-up visit. The trust's goals were deliberately unambitious, because ambition entailed risk, and after the resolution of my father's debts, the focus was on maintenance, on providing enough for my mother and me to live on, and if they planned correctly, my great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren as well. Once it became clear that the firm would totter on whether I was there or not, I began taking long breaks. The offices were downtown in a beautiful old Spanish-style building, and I would leave at 11 before the lunch crowds and walk the few blocks to Chinatown. I drew a salary, but I lived modestly. I would go to a restaurant that served a bowl of pork and shrimp wonton min for a quarter, and after paying, I would wander the streets, past the hawkers arranging their pyramids of starfruit and rambutan, past the apothecaries with their bins of shriveled roots and dried seeds, their rows of glass jars filled with a cloudy liquid and curls of herbs and different unidentifiable animal paws shorn of their fur. Nothing ever changed in Hawaii. It was as if every day I walked onto a stage set, and every morning, long before I woke, it was unfurled, swept clean, and readied for me to pass through it again. Of course I was lonely. Some of the boys who I had been able to pretend were my friends in high school came back to town as well, but they were busy with graduate school or their new jobs, and much of my time was spent as it had been when I was a child, in my bedroom at my mother's house, or in the sunroom watching television on the little black and white set I had bought with some of my salary. On weekends, I went to watch The Fisherman at Waimanalo or Kaimana. I went to the movies. I turned 22, and then 23. One day, when I was 24, I was driving back to town. It was late in the evening. By this time, I had stopped going to work entirely, phasing myself out of the life of the office until I simply never returned. No one seemed upset or even surprised by this. It was my money, after all, and it continued to come to me in the form of a paycheck every 2 weeks. I was driving through Kailua, which was at the time a very small town, with none of the stores and restaurants it would have a decade later, when I passed a bus stop. 2 times a month, I drove around the entire island, 1 week going east, the next west. It was a way to pass the time, and I would sit on the beach near the stone church in Laie, where my father had once handed out money, and look at the sea. The bus stop was beneath a street lamp, one of the few on the road, and seated at its bench was a young woman. I was driving slow enough so that I could see she had dark hair pulled back from her face and wore a printed orange cotton skirt. In the light, she appeared to be glowing. She sat very straight, her legs together, her hands folded in her lap, her purse strap looped over one wrist. I don't know why I didn't just drive on, but I didn't. I turned around in the road, which was deserted, and returned to her. "Hello," I said when I was close to her, and she looked back at me. "Hello," she said. "Where are you going?" I asked. "I'm waiting for the bus to town," she said. "The bus doesn't run this late," I said, and for the first time, she looked worried. "Oh, no," she said. "I have to get back to the dorm, or they'll lock the doors." "I can drop you off," I offered. And she hesitated, looking up and down the dark, empty road. "You can sit in the back seat," I added. At this, she nodded and smiled. "Thank you," she said. "I'd be very grateful." She sat the same way as she had at the bus stop, erect and poised, her eyes straight ahead. I studied her in the rearview mirror. "I'm a student at the university," she finally said, as if by way of an offering. "What year are you?" I asked. "A junior," she said, "but I'm only here for the year." She was on an exchange program, she said. The next year, she would return to Minneapolis and graduate from her college there. Her name was Alice. I began seeing her. She lived in one of the girls' dormitories, Freer Hall, and I would wait in the lobby until she came down. Every Wednesday, she took weaving lessons in Kailua with an old Hawaiian lady, for which she always wore a modest knee-length skirt and her hair pulled back. Otherwise, she wore jeans and let her hair loose. I could tell from its texture and the shape of her nose that she wasn't entirely Haole, but I didn't understand what she actually was. "I'm Spanish," she said, but I knew from my time on the mainland that Spanish could sometimes mean Mexican or Puerto Rican or something else altogether. She talked about her studies and how she had come here because she wanted to be somewhere warm for once in her life, but had grown to love it about how she wanted to go back home and become a teacher, and about how she missed her mother, her father was dead, and little brother. She talked about how she wanted a life full of adventure, about how living in Hawaii was a little like living abroad, and someday she would live in China and India, and when the war was over, Thailand too. We talked about what was happening in Vietnam, and about the election, and about music. In each case, she had more to say than I did. Sometimes she asked about my life, but there wasn't much to tell. And yet, she seemed to like me well enough. She was very gentle with me, and when I made mistakes, fumbling for too long with her clothes, she placed my hands on her shoulders and unbuttoned her dress herself. We had sex in her room one night when her roommate was out. She had to tell me what to do and how, and at first I was embarrassed, and then I felt nothing at all. Afterward, I thought about the experience. It had been neither pleasant nor unpleasant, but I was glad I had done it, and glad it was over. I felt I had crossed some important threshold, one that marked me as an adult, even as my daily life belied it. If it had been less enjoyable than I had assumed it would be, it had also been easier, and we met for a few times more, and it made me feel like my life was moving forward. Now comes the part you know, Kavika, which is also the hard part. Of course, Alice knew who my family was, but it seemed she hadn't realized its full implications until she had returned home. By the time the letter arrived at the firm, I had had the first of my seizures. Initially, I assumed they were headaches. The world would quiet and flatten, and shifting fields of color, of the kind we used to see together after we stared at the sun and then shut our eyes, would float across my field of vision. When I came to, it might be a minute later or an hour, and then I would be woozy and disoriented. After I was diagnosed, I lost my driver's license. From there on, Matthew would have to drive me, and if Matthew was unavailable, my mother. So, I cannot quite remember the exact sequence of events that brought you home to me. I know your grandmother told you that your mother had effectively abandoned you, writing to Uncle William and telling him that someone had to come retrieve you because she was leaving Minneapolis again, this time to study in Japan, and her own mother was in no position to take care of a baby. Later, Uncle William told me that, while Alice had contacted the firm, it was your grandmother who, upon receiving evidence that you were in fact a Bingham, offered your mother money. Alice, your mother, countered with a different sum, one that Uncle William warned your grandmother would necessitate selling the house in Hana. "Do it," she told him, and she didn't need to explain why. You would be the heir of the family, and there was no guarantee that I would ever produce another. She had to take the opportunity she was presented. A month later, Uncle William flew to Minnesota and had the papers countersigned. When he returned, it was with you. It was an echo of my mother's own alleged origins, though neither of us ever acknowledged that. I cannot say which version was true. I can say she had never told me, not that she was pregnant, not that she had given birth. She disappeared from my life after the end of the 1967 school year. I do know that she is indeed dead. She married at some point in the early 70s to a man she met while a student in Kobe. They were killed in a boating accident in 74. But as for why neither she nor her family ever made contact with you, I can only imagine it was because the terms of arrangement she made with your grandmother prohibited it. You cannot be bitter about this, Kavika. Not bitter toward your grandmother or toward Alice. One wanted you very badly, and the other hadn't planned on becoming a mother. I can also say that you are and always were the joy of my life. That having you made me feel I might have something to contribute after all. you were still a baby when I got you. And in those years, when you were learning to roll over and sit and walk and talk, my mother and I were in harmony because of you. Sometimes we would sit on the floor in the sunroom, watching you kick your legs and babble. And as we laughed or clapped at your efforts, we would sometimes catch each other's eye. And it was as if we were not mother and son, but husband and wife. And you were our child. She was always proud of you, Kavika, as I was, and as I am. She still is. I know it. She's just disappointed because she misses you, as I miss you too. And here, I must restate that I never blamed you for leaving me. I was not your responsibility. You were mine. You had to find your way out of a situation you should never have been in at all. Over the years, I kept waiting for the day you would ask about your mother, but you never did. I'll admit that I was relieved, although later I came to realize that you might not have asked because you wanted to protect me, because you were always trying to protect me, when I was the one who should have been protecting you. Your apparent lack of interest in your mother was the subject of a fight I had with your grandmother, one of the few times I stood up to her. "It's strange," she had said, after a parent-teacher conference we had attended, in which your teacher had mentioned that she didn't know anything about your mother. "Strange how incurious he is." She was implying that this meant you were slow, somehow. Slow or tepid. And I barked at her. "So you want him to start asking?" I demanded. And she shrugged, slightly, not lifting her eyes from her quilting ring. "Of course not," she said. "I just think it's odd that he doesn't." I was furious with her. "He's just a little boy," I said, "and he believes what you told him. I can't believe you're complaining about the fact that he trusts you, that you're trying to make it sound like a flaw." I got up and left the room. And that night, she had Jane prepare rice pudding, your favorite, which I knew was her way of apologizing to you, even though you would never know that it was an apology. Eventually, it became easy for us to pretend that you'd never had a mother at all. There was a Japanese folktale that you had liked me to tell you, about a boy who was born from a peach and found by an old childless couple. "Read me Momotaro again," you'd say. And then, when I had, "again." After a while, I began telling you a version about a boy, Mangotaro, who was discovered inside a mango hanging from the tree in our yard, and how that boy grew up to have many adventures and make many friends. The story always ended with the boy leaving his father and grandmother and aunt and uncle and going far away, where he would have new adventures and make new friends. I knew even then that my job was to remain, and yours was to leave, to go somewhere I would never see, to have a life of your own. "What happens next?" you'd ask when the story was over, and I'd kissed you goodnight. "You'll have to come back and tell me someday," I'd say. Kavika, it happened again. I had a dream that I was standing, and not just standing, but walking. My hands were extended before me, like a zombie, and I was shuffling one foot and then the other. And then I realized that, again, I wasn't dreaming, but really walking. And I began to concentrate, using my hands to touch the walls, edging my way around the room. My bed is in the center of the room, which I knew because I'd heard my mother complain about it. Why, she wondered, was it in the center, instead of pressed up against one wall or another? And yet I was glad of it, because it made the space easier to navigate. Here was the wall of windows that looked over the garden. Here was the doorway to the bathroom, where I was taken for my baths and showers. Here was the door, locked, to, I imagined, the hallway. Here was a chest of drawers, on top of which were a few bottles, some heavy, some light, some glass, some plastic. I opened the top drawers and felt my shorts, my t-shirts. The floor was cold, tile or stone. But as I neared my bed, I encountered a different surface, which I recognized as a woven Lauhala mat, satiny beneath my feet, the same kind as I'd had in my room back home. They kept the whole room cool, Jane used to say. And even though they splintered and shagged, they were easy to replace every few months. After I found my way back to bed, I lay awake for a long time, for I had realized, what if I were to leave? If I could walk, was it not possible that other things would return to me as well? My eyesight, for example. My speech. What if I were to walk out of here one night? What if I were to come find you? Wouldn't that be a surprise? To see you again? To hold you again? I knew that in the meantime, I wouldn't tell anyone. Not until I'd practiced more. And indeed, the walk, as short as it was, had left me panting. But now you know too. I'm going to come find you. I'm going to walk there myself. I had been walking as well the day I re-encountered Edward. It was 1969, and I had had you for just 4 months. You weren't yet a year old. A few times a week, I had Matthew drive us down to Kapiolani Park, where I'd push you among the monkey pod and shower trees. Sometimes we'd stop to watch the cricket club play their matches. Or sometimes I'd walk you over to Kaimana Beach, where I used to linger to watch the fishermen. Back then, and maybe even now, it was unusual to see a young man pushing a carriage, and sometimes people would laugh. I never said anything, though. Never spoke back. Just kept moving. So that morning, when I felt, rather than saw, someone stopped to stare, I didn't think anything of it. And it wasn't until the person spoke my name that I too stopped, and then only because I recognized the voice. "How have you been?" he asked, as if it had been just a week, rather than nearly a decade, since we had seen each other last. "Pretty good," I said, shaking his hand. I had heard he had moved to Los Angeles, where he had gone to college, and told him so, but he shrugged. "I just came back," he said. Then he looked into the carriage. "Whose baby is that?" he asked. "Mine," I said, and he blinked. Another person might have brayed in astonishment or thought I was joking, but he only nodded. I remembered that he had never joked. I never thought anyone else was joking either. "Your son," he said, as if tasting the word. "Little Kavika," he said, testing out the name. "Or does he go by David?" "No, Kavika," I said, and he smiled slightly. "Good," he said. Somehow, it was arranged that we should go get something to eat, and we loaded everything into his beat-up car and drove to Chinatown, where we went to my 25-cent wonton min restaurant. On the way, I asked about his mother, and I knew by his silence, the way his face twisted before he answered, that she was dead. Breast cancer, he said. It was why he was home. "I wish I had known," I said. I felt as if I had been punched. But he shrugged. "It was slow, and then quick," he said. "She didn't suffer too much. I buried her in Honoka'a." After that lunch, we began seeing each other again. It wasn't as if we discussed it. He just told me he'd pick me up on Sunday at noon, and we could go to the beach. And I agreed. Over the weeks, and then months, we saw more and more of each other, until I was seeing him at least every other day. Curiously, we rarely discussed where he'd been, or where I'd been, or what we'd done in the years since we saw each other last, or why we had drifted apart in the first place. But although the past was not so much forgotten as it was excised, we were both careful, again without ever discussing it, about not letting my mother discover our renewed communication. When he came, I would wait, sometimes with you, sometimes alone, on the porch if she was out, or at the bottom of the hill if she was home, which is where Edward dropped me off as well. It's difficult to remember what we discussed in those days. This may surprise you to hear, but it took me many months to realize that Edward had changed in some fundamental way. I don't mean the kind of change we all experience when we move from childhood to adulthood, but that, in his beliefs and convictions, he had become someone I no longer recognized. Part of this, I'm embarrassed to say, is that because he looked very much the same, I assumed he was very much the same. I knew, from television news reports, that the mainland was full of long-haired hippies. And while there were hippies in Honolulu as well, there was no sense of rage, of revolution. Everything came late to Hawaii. Even our papers carried day-old news. And so, if you had seen Edward then, you wouldn't have been able to immediately identify him as a political radical by sight alone. Yes, his hair was longer, fluffier than mine, but it was always clean. The effect was less intimidating than it was merely pretty. Neither of us worked. Unlike me, Edward had not finished his degree. He had, he eventually explained, dropped out at the beginning of his senior year and had spent the rest of the fall hitchhiking through the West. When he needed money, he returned to California and picked grapes or garlic or strawberries or walnuts, whatever was being harvested. He would never eat another strawberry in his life, he said. Now back in Honolulu, he found short-term jobs. He helped a friend paint houses or joined a moving crew for a few days. The little house he'd shared with his mother was a rental. The landlord, an old Chinese man who'd fancied Mrs. Bishop, and he'd have to move out of it eventually. But he didn't seem concerned about this or his future. He seemed concerned about very little, and it reminded me of his childhood self-assurance, his complete lack of insecurity. But it was toward the end of that year that I realized how truly different a person he had become. "We're going to an event," he said, as he picked me up at the foot of the hill one evening, "to meet some friends of mine." He didn't offer any further information, and I, as usual, didn't ask. But I could tell he was excited, even nervous. As he drove, he beat out a twitchy rhythm on the steering wheel with one finger. We drove deep into Nu'uanu, down a narrow private road, so shrouded by trees and so ill-lit that even with the headlights, I had to hold up a flashlight to guide our way. We passed a series of gates, and at the fourth, Edward stopped and got out of the car. There was a key attached to a long piece of wire on the gatepost, and he unlocked the gate, and we drove through, stopping again to close the gate behind us. Ahead of us was a long dirt driveway, and as we bumped along, I could see and smell that it was lined with clumps of white ginger, their flowers ghostly in the dusk. At the end of the driveway was a large white wooden house, once grand, once well-maintained, that resembled my own, except parked in front of it were at least 20 cars, and even from outside we could hear people talking, their voices echoey in the valley's quiet. "Come on," Edward said. There were perhaps 50 people inside, and after I had recovered from my initial shock, I was able to observe them more closely. Most of them were our age, and all of them were local, and some of them were clearly hippies. And many of them were standing around a very tall black man, whose back was toward me, so that all I could see was his afro, which was large and thick and glistening. As he shifted, the top of his hair brushed against the bottom of the ceiling pendant light, making it sway, the light rocking about the room. "Come on," Edward said again, and this time I could hear the excitement in his voice. The crowd began to stir as a single organism, and we found ourselves being moved from the entryway and into a large open space. Here, as in the first room, there was no furniture, and some of the floorboards had cracked and split from the moisture. In this room, above the chatter, I heard a roaring, like an airplane passing overhead. But then I looked out the window and realized the sound was coming from a waterfall at the bottom of the property. After we had all settled ourselves on the floor, there was a nervous silence, one that seemed to lengthen and deepen. "The fuck's happening?" someone, a guy, asked and was shushed. Someone else giggled. On and on the silence went, and finally, the shuffling and whispering quieted, and for at least a minute, we sat there, together, mute and immobile. It was then that the tall black man picked himself up from where he'd been sitting in the middle of the crowd and loped to the front of the room. The combination of his height and our position on the ground, staring up at him, made him seem towering, an edifice rather than a man. He was not so black, I was darker than he was, nor was he exactly handsome. His skin was shiny, and he had a patchy beard and a smattering of pimples across his left cheek that made him look more childlike than I think he'd have preferred. But there was something indisputable about him. He had a wide, gap-toothed smile that he could make look either goofy or fierce, and long, liquid arms and legs that he bent and twisted into shapes as he moved, so that you were forced to not only listen to him, but to watch him as well. But it was his voice that really captivated. What he said, but also how he said it. Gentle and low and furred. His was a voice you'd like to hear telling you how much he loved you, and why, and how. He began with a smile. "Brothers and sisters," he said. "Aloha." The crowd clapped then, and his smile widened, sleepy and seductive. "Aloha and mahalo for bringing me to this beautiful land of yours. It seems particularly right to me that we should be at this house tonight. For do you know what I was told the name of this house is?" "Yes, that's right. It has a name. That's something all fancy houses do, I guess, all over the world. It's Hale Ke Aloha, the house of aloha, the house of love, the house of the beloved. And that's particularly interesting to me, because I, too, am named after a house, Bethesda. Who of you here remember your Bible, your New Testament? Ah, I see a hand in the back. There's another. You, sister in the back, tell me what it means." "That's right. The pools of Bethesda. Bethesda meaning the house of mercy. The pools being the place where Christ healed the crippled man. So here I am. The house of mercy in the house of love. I was asked to come, not just here tonight, but to your islands, your home, by my good friend, the brother sitting all the way to the right, Brother Lewis. Thank you, Brother Lewis. I'm ashamed to say this now, but when I was invited to come here, I thought I knew everything about what this place was. I thought, pineapples. I thought, rainbows. I thought, hula girls, swaying their hips back and forth, all nice and sweet. I know. But that's what I thought. But within a few days, even before I left California, I realized I was wrong. I'm also ashamed to say that I didn't even want to come here, not at first. You know, what you have here, I thought, is not reality. It's not part of the world. I live near Oakland. That is part of the world. You see what's happening there, what we're struggling against there, what we're fighting against there, the oppression of the black man and woman, the oppression that's gone on since America was founded and will go on and on until it burns down to the ground and we begin something new, because there is no fixing what America is. There is no way to do work around the margins and say justice has been restored. No, brothers and sisters, that's not how justice works. My mother worked as a nurse's aide in what they used to call the Houston Negro Hospital, and she would tell me stories of the men and women who came in with heart attacks, about how they'd be gasping for breath, about how their nails would turn blue because they weren't getting enough oxygen. My mother would be told by the senior nurses to massage her patient's hands, to get the blood flowing through the extremities. And as she did, she'd watch their nails turn pink again and feel their hands warm up with her touch. But one day she realized that this wasn't solving anything. She was making their hands prettier, maybe even work better, but their hearts were still sick. Nothing had really changed after all. And in the same way, nothing has really changed here. America is a country with sin at its heart. You know what I'm talking about. One group of people sent away from their land, another group of people stolen from their land. We replaced you, and yet we never wanted to replace you. We wanted to be left where we were. None of our ancestors, our great, great, great-grandparents ever woke up one day and thought, let's sail halfway around the world, be part of a land grab, pit ourselves against some other native peoples. No way, no how. That is not how normal people, decent people think. That is how the devil thinks. But that sin, that mark, never goes away. And although we didn't cause it, we are all infected by it. Let me tell you why. Imagine that heart again, but this time swiped with a smear of oil. Not cooking oil, but motor oil. The thick, gluey black kind. The kind that sticks to your hands and clothes like tar. It's just a small bit of oil, you think. And eventually, it'll get washed away. And so you try to forget about it. But that isn't what happens. What happens instead is that with each beat, with each thump of your heart, that oil, that little mark, spreads and spreads. The arteries carry it away. The veins carry it back. And with each journey through your body, it leaves a deposit. So that eventually, not right away, but over time, every organ, every blood vessel, every cell has been tainted by that oil. Sometimes you can't even see it, but you know it's there. Because by this time, brothers and sisters, that oil is everywhere. It's coating the inside of your veins. It's lining your large intestine and liver. It's slicking your spleen and kidneys, your brain. That little bit of oil, that little splotch that you thought you could ignore, it's now everywhere. And now there is no way to clean it out. The only way to clean it out is to stop the heart altogether. The only way to clean it out is to burn the body pure of it. The only way to clean it is to end it. You want to eliminate the stain, you've got to eliminate the host. Now, what does this have to do with us here in Hawaii, you might be saying? The country, you might be saying, is not a body. The metaphor doesn't hold. But doesn't it? Here we sit, brothers and sisters, in this beautiful place far from Oakland. And yet, it's not far at all. Because here's the thing, brothers and sisters. You do have pineapples here. You do have rainbows. You do have hula girls. But none of those things are yours. Those pineapple fields Brother Lewis took me to see? Who are they owned by? Not by you. Those rainbows? You have them. But can you see them for those high-rises going up? Those hotels and condominiums in Waikiki? And who owns those buildings? Do you? How about you? Those hula girls? Those are your sisters, your brown-skinned sisters, and yet you're letting them dance? For whom? This is the dissonance of living here. This is the lie you've been fed. I look at all of you here, your brown faces, your kinky hair, and then I look at who's running this place. I look at who your elected officials are. I look at who runs your banks, your businesses, your schools. They don't look like you. So, you're poor? You got no money? You want to go to school? You want to buy a house? And yet you can't? And why? Why do you think that is? Is it because you're all stupid? Is it because you don't deserve to go to school? To have some place to live? Is it because you're bad? Or is it because you've let yourselves sleep? Because you've let yourselves forget? You live in a land not of milk and honey, but of sugar and sun. And yet you've become drunk on it. You've become lazy on it. You've become complacent on it. And what's happened while you surfed and sang and swayed your hips? Your land, your very soul, has been taken from you, bit by bit by bit, right beneath your brown noses, while you watched it happen and did nothing, nothing to stop it. Anyone watching you would think you wanted to give it all up. Take my land, you said. Take it all, because I don't care. I won't stand in your way. He took a breath then, rocked back on his heels, swiped a red bandana across his forehead. The crowd had been utterly still, but now a hiss sizzled in the air, like a flock of insects. And when he spoke next, his voice was kinder, softer, almost placating. Brothers and sisters, we have something else in common. We are both from lands of kings. We both were kings and queens and princes and princesses. We both had wealth, handed down from father to son to grandson to great-grandson. You all are lucky, though, because you remember your kings and queens. You know their names. You know where they're buried. It's 1969, my friends. 1969. That means it's only been 71 years since your land was stolen by the Americans. 76 since your queen was betrayed by the American devils. And here you are, not all of you, mind, but enough of you, brothers and sisters, enough of you, calling yourselves American. American? You believe that America is for everyone bullshit? America is not for everyone. It is not for us. You know that, don't you? In your hearts and in your souls. You know that America despises you, don't you? They want your land, your fields, and your mountains, but America don't want you. This land was never their land. Legally, it's barely their land. This land was taken. That is not your fault. But letting it stay taken? Well, that is your fault. You've let them buy you off, brothers and sisters. You've let them promise that they would give you some of your land back. But look around you. You know that there are more of you in prison than anyone else here? You know that there are more of you in poverty than anyone else? You know that there are more of you that go hungry than anyone else? You know that you die younger, that your babies die sooner, that you die in childbirth more than anyone else? You are Hawaiians.